This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg.
Later on, the presidential candidates on immigration, exploiting the politics of resentment.
But first,
Healthcare justice.
Well, we're about to get a home visit from a doctor. Hey, what doctors do home visits anymore? Well, ours does, Dr. Donald E. Moore. And you know, while millions of Americans are scrambling to re-enroll in health insurance programs under the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare, before the January 31st deadline, surely they can't help but be frustrated by the limitations of the private insurance marketplace. Well, our guest, Dr. Donald Moore, while noting the gains made under Obamacare, and there are some, sees its defects play out in his own efforts to provide good medical care to patients. In addition to often increasing out-of-pocket expenses, the insurance companies dictate which specialists he can refer patients to, and he is pressured to shorten patient visits and bill them more. In response, he has gone single payer, or advocates Medicare for all, refusing to work with private insurers, and now mainly accepting patients under Medicare and Medicaid. He is urging all doctors to join the movement for Medicare for All, single payer, to reform the healthcare system based on inefficient private health care insurance with its high administrative overhead and profit margins. He is joined with other doctors in the Physicians for National Health program in lobbying the New York State Legislature to institute a single-payer system. We'll find out more about it. And Dr. Donald E. Moore, MD, MPH, past president of the Medical Society of the County of Kings and board member of Physicians for a National Health Plan. It's nice to have you with us. And, hey, give us your prescription with this home visit for real preventative care.
Pleasure to join you all. Let me just point out that I make real house calls. 2 days a week, I go out there, and I'm usually all over Brooklyn, and sometimes all the way up to the Bronx, where I actually see patients in their homes. And I think it's something that is really needed. We need to do a lot more of it, and I just want to really make a plug for doctors making more house calls.
I was amazed. I'm delighted, and you're invited.
The problem that we have currently is that we have a healthcare system that doesn't really work for anyone except the insurance companies. It doesn't work for the providers. And the providers are not just the doctors. The providers are the hospitals and all the health professionals that earnestly try to provide service to their patients. The healthcare system really doesn't work for the patients either, because as most of you out there in Radioland know, every time you try to access health care, whether you go to the hospital, to the ER, to your doctor, you have to shell out some money. It's called generally a copay. Copay is a fixed amount you pay every time you try to get health care. Copays are foreign in most other countries. They don't know what a copay is. You go to most of the countries in Europe that have good health care systems. You go to Canada, they don't pay copays. And then there's the co-insurance. Your bill is $100, you have to pay 20%. That's how Medicare currently exists, and most other insurances have even higher co-insurances. And, of course, the deductible, that's the worst part. The deductible is the part where before you get any health care, you have to come up with a certain amount of money. Obamacare, or the Affordable Care Act, basically ask those who are uninsured to go to an exchange and get insurance. If you go on that exchange, you will see that the so-called bronze plans, the ones that are affordable to most people, those plans have very, very high deductibles. The deductibles may go as high as $5,000, $6,000 for an individual. For a family, it may be $13,000, $14,000. So it really doesn't create access for the average person. People who who have more means to buy better health insurance plans, they don't have those high deductibles. So it's the usual situation. The less you have, the less access you have. So Martin Luther King talked about that injustice in health care being amongst the worst injustice that we could perpetrate against each other, injustice in health care. Aristotle talked about how a society should and has the ability to provide health to its population. So these are not new concepts. What is terrible, though, is that after all these years of evolution, particularly in America, we haven't figured out how to care for the health of the entire population. Well, my prescription is, why don't we just have Medicare for everybody? Medicare exists. It's not a new concept. Most of us understand it. Medicare currently is the insurance that people over 65 get. We're talking about Medicare. That's a little bit better. A Medicare without deductibles, a Medicare without coinsurances, and a Medicare without copayments. We're talking about an improved Medicare, and we're talking about an expanded Medicare that does not start at 65 years old, but starts from the day you're born. That's not too difficult, because we already have the administrative structure for that. And that structure that we give our population Medicare is much better than what happens when we do it through private insurance companies. It's also much cheaper. The private insurance companies' administrative cost to administer care is about 20% on the average and can get as high as 30%. For each dollar you spend on that premium, when you buy a commercial insurance, 20 to 30 cents of that dollar goes to administrative costs. Yet, when we take our tax dollars and pay for Medicare, only 2 to 3 cents go to the administrative costs. Part of that administrative cost in the commercial insurance line goes to profits. And we know about those profits. We know about the high salaries that the CEOs and top executives of the insurance companies get. We also know about the waste and the duplication that occurs in those commercial insurances. Medicare administers care for a much larger group of people and do it at a much lower cost. And it's done through our tax, which works a lot better than trying to collect premium either through your employer, which is how it's done for the most part in the commercial sector. So my prescription, the prescription of the colleagues that agree with me, those who belong to the Physicians for a National Health Program, is Medicare for all, an improved and expanded Medicare. So that's our prescription. Obamacare was really an inadequate attempt to fix what I see as a broken healthcare delivery. Well, really, a broken healthcare financing system. We have problems with the delivery system, but I think the financing is really where things get messed up. So Obamacare basically was to increase the amount of people who have health insurance. Back in 2010, when the Affordable Care Act was put into law, we had about 15% of the population that was uninsured. Basically, they had no insurance at all. The plan, that was somewhere around 50 million people. The intent of that law was not to insure the whole 50 million, but to insure about 30 million. And most of those would have been people who were close to the poverty level who did not qualify for Medicaid. And Medicaid is not even across the country. Some states are more generous with Medicaid, and some states basically give very little Medicaid and basically don't do a good job covering the low-income part of the population. So the Affordable Care Act was really designed to expand Medicaid to a group that was just above the poverty level who pretty much could not afford health insurance. And basically for those who were a little bit better off to give subsidies. For the very rich, it didn't matter. They always can access good health care with or without insurance. So if the insurance situation gets worse, they just pay for the cost of the care. So it's really the middle class that really didn't benefit from the Affordable Care Act. The people, the poorest, definitely did, at least in certain states. However, as usual, there is a bait and switch. The bait was this. The Affordable Care Act said, all right, we want to encourage doctors to take Medicaid. So we will pay the doctors the same amount that we would pay them if the person had Medicare. The way it was before, Medicare paid a reasonable rate. Medicaid paid a much lower rate, which is why many physicians did not participate with Medicaid. And I'll tell you how bad this was. I remember taking Medicaid as insurance. I would see a patient in the office, and I would get $6 for that care, whether I spent an hour with the patient or I spent 20 minutes with the patient. And I wouldn't spend less than that because I can't see how one can deliver health care in much less time than that. But it would be $6. Well, eventually that rate got raised to $30. As you probably know, $30 is a cab fare generally, that may take about 10 minutes. So, and that barely covers the cost of that cab driver's cost to operate the car. So you can imagine operating a medical office and getting $6 a visit. That really didn't make sense. As a matter of fact, most physicians considered that an insult. So there clearly was an improvement over time. But once we got to the Affordable Care Act and we did increase the amount of people that had insurance, we didn't cover the entire population. We increased the amount of people who had insurance. We then did the switch. The switch was we took the Medicaid and we privatized it. In New York, most of Medicaid today is privatized. Many people who have Medicaid will understand what I'm talking about. They're going along with their Medicaid, and all of a sudden one day they got a letter in the mail that said, you are now a member of this insurance company. Just to give an example of the name, you are
Dr. Mm-hmm. Moore, let me just interrupt you since the
Please.
Clock is,
yes.
is running away and I could listen and our listeners will listen to you more frequently because I know that you're going to be back for more home visits. But in the last minute that we have left for this segment, tell us about how we can get on board with the New York State legislature, a single-payer system in New York State, or Medicare for All. And while the Assembly recently overwhelmingly passed such a bill, it hasn't gone through the Senate yet. How do we get on board with this? Because
okay.
that's where we're going.
Definitely. New York Health Campaign, that's the site that you can go on to sign on to the single-payer bill in the Senate. New York Health Campaign. Or if you want to get more information, you can sign on to PNHP Metro. That's Physicians for a National Health Program, PNHP Metro. Metro meaning this area, New York. Either one of those sites, you can navigate your way to more information. You can sign a petition for Medicare for All. Well, in this case, it would be the New York Health Bill. So that in New York State, we can all have a decent health insurance that is affordable and that will cover the entire population in New York.
Promise to come back again?
Oh, I certainly would love to.
Well, we've been speaking to Dr. Donald Moore, MD, MPH, past president of the Medical Society of the County of Kings and board member, most significantly, of Physicians for a National Health Plan. And he made a home visit to get us on board for understanding and supporting and implementing, finally, a Medicare for All or a single-payer system. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Mimi. Have a great day.
America is a melting pot. Or is this a false accusation? Of the have-to-haves and the have-to-have-nots.
We're waiting in anticipation.
Sing up here like Johnny on the spot.
In every other industrialized nation.
So when will we have what we have not got? Talking about a do-or-die situation.
No, we are not satisfied, and we will not be satisfied until justice rolls down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream.
Our next guest, who is speaking to us from El Salvador, Oscar Chacon, who's the executive director of Alianza America. When New York billionaire and GOP presidential candidate Donald Trump launched into his anti-immigrant tirade against Mexicans crossing the border, he was using a long-known political technique of plugging into the live wire of American resentment of the other. Most recently, Latinos, more precisely, those from southern borders, Mexicans, Salvadorians, Guatemalans, Hondurans, and the like. And no doubt, the recent tragedies in France will be exploited to promote a new wave of fear and antagonism towards immigrants and migrants of Arab descent. Oscar, thank you so much for joining us. Help put in perspective what perhaps hasn't been happening on the part of either the Republican or the Democratic candidates when it comes to meaningful immigration reform.
I think it is important for the listeners to understand that the calculation by at least a faction within the Republican Party leadership is that they can gain more voters than they lose by pandering to racism and xenophobia, specifically against Mexican and other Latin American immigrants in the U.S., and that this is not a conclusion that is universal among all Republicans, but clearly somebody like Donald Trump has come to believe that, again, I mean, that formula may well render a Republican in the White House. This is not a new formula. If we go back to 1994, there was a dying effort to reelect a Republican governor in California, and precisely by embracing the approach that is now being taken primarily by Donald Trump, that candidate, Pete Wilson, managed to actually get reelected and in the way actually pass one of the worst anti-immigrant laws by way of a referendum, Proposition 187. The history of these type of attacks, it didn't begin really with Donald Trump launching his presidential campaign last June, but it goes back at least 25 years. While the referendum I made mention of, Proposition 187, was largely neutralized by our federal court system because it was largely unconstitutional, the reality is that the most precious achievement of that particular wave of anti-immigrant sentiment didn't actually happen at a state level. It happened at the federal level with the passage of the most restrictive, the most exclusionary, and most punishable U.S. immigration law in history at the time, the so-called Illegal Immigration Reform and Immigrant Responsibility Act of 1996. All this assault against immigrants has taken place in the same stretch of time where we have seen the steady decay in the economic and social status of white segments of Americans, particularly of many white Americans who for long thought of themselves as middle class. And this has created a pernicious environment where economic insecurity and long-held racist and xenophobic beliefs have combined in a way that makes possible for extremist political offerings like the one being made by Donald Trump to actually gain traction. Now, where do Democrats have been standing in relationship to all of this? Frankly, most Democrats, at least since 1996 all the way to the present, have actually been able to get away, essentially being perceived as the good cops, I mean, in this story, when it comes to immigrants and immigration policy, by simply declaring that they like immigrants, but without actually doing tangible things to demonstrate how much those commitments really go. And we are only recently beginning to see a bit of change in this regard. In places, whether it is cities or states where Democrats fully control, you know, the political system, we haven't really seen a true embracing of the notion that immigrants are good for the country and therefore we ought to treat them, you know, with a great sense of equality. So in essence, you know, when I look at the presidential campaign already and I hear the Democratic Party candidates talking about immigrants, I am not yet hearing truly alternative ways in which a voter, especially a Latino voter for whom, you know, immigration is close to our heart, really hitting significantly different positions. And let me just give you five ideas what Democrats could do. They should begin to fully defy the notion that immigrants are bad for the country and speaking over and over again about all the positive contributions made by Mexican, Latin American, and other immigrants in the U.S. They should be consistently defying the rhetoric that paints immigrants as lawbreakers. Instead, they should be speaking about the fact that immigration policy, in a way, reflects the reality of an incapable political class that has failed to actually periodically and wisely modernize our immigration policies to reflect the kind of world we live in. Whenever Democrats are in political control positions, as I already said, they should be absolutely moving forward, passing laws that truly make immigrants equal members of our society. They should be flatly rejecting the 1996 immigration policy for its deeply xenophobic, racist, you know, nature, and instead they should be speaking about the importance of reversing that particular law and embracing a new immigration law that truly reflects all the good things that immigrants have actually contributed. And perhaps more importantly than all of the above, Democrats should be embracing fully the need to profoundly reform our social and economic system so that we can bring about a decisive break with the generation of policies enacted since essentially the late 1970s and forward that have brought us to the level of economic inequality that is so prevalent today. In the end, it is the duty of good citizens to find ways to get better politically organized so that we can push for these changes to come about and not just wait for a particular party or a particular politician to actually lead the way, because that's unlikely to happen.
After the catastrophic events in France, we have seen Donald Trump declaring that there should be inspection of mosques, possibly closing of mosques, a ferocious and frightening wave of antagonism and recalling of any sympathy for refugees from Syria. Can you build that into the mix in terms of the question of migration and the new antipathies to people of Arab descent?
No doubt about it. I mean, I think that we are likely to indeed see more of the kind of verbal attack against not just immigrants in general, but right now, probably once again, a focus on Muslims, a focus on Arabs, you know, immigrants in the country, as if they all are some sort of illness that we need to terminate. This is extremely dangerous because, as we well know, this is exactly the kind of wave that we saw post 9/11, and it did not do us any good because the reality is we need to look much more deeply into what is it that has led to the kind of events that we saw in Paris. It is important to keep in mind what we need to really do is to understand that the best way we can actually avoid going into a very dangerous path, I mean, attacking different kinds of immigrants just because we want to associate them with national security threats, is to actually embrace the notion that the best thing we could do is to open up a window of opportunity for these communities to actually be able to function fully as members of society, opening up, you know, immigration status for them. This would make very feasible for us to once and for all clear up that the vast majority of people who are in the U.S. as immigrants are there because they care about the country, because they're contributing, because they're not only helping the U.S. but also helping their own countries by virtue of remittances that they send on a monthly basis. And again, I mean, rather than tempting ourselves, I mean, with going again, I mean, into a path that is essentially a path where we only saw more suspicion about one another, we should be embracing a path that is more about building harmony in society.
You seem to be moving in the direction of saying neither the Democratic and certainly not the Republican Party are going to come up with the kind of agenda and the kind of initiatives that is going to lead to meaningful immigration reform. So where do we place our eggs? In which basket? Is it a more robust and muscular response from our communities led particularly by people who are immigrants? Is that what we need to do?
Absolutely. If one thing history teaches us is that it has hardly ever been the case that the people in D.C., the people in Congress, are actually ahead of the rest of us on what needs to happen. I mean, they can respond, but it is imperative that we understand that we must put most of our faith in actually getting common people to be able to organize and to organize, you know, politically in a way that we can actually influence what kind of debate and what kind of decision-making happens. I don't believe that we are departing from zero. I mean, there is a lot already going on, but there is indeed much more harmony, much more synergy that needs to be built among multiple actors that, as I said, I mean, are already engaged. But I think it is important to not get lost on the idea that if we elect, you know, candidate A versus candidate B, that in itself is going to produce miracles. I think that we need to understand that re-engineering ourselves, I mean, from a, you know, social, political organizing capability is what in the end will make a difference and will allow us to sustain whatever change we can bring about in the short term.
What is fundamental that must be accomplished?
Well, I mean, I think that they all have been promising that if they get elected, that they will do more executive actions. I welcome those announcements, but on the other hand, I ask myself, what could a new president do that President Obama didn't already try to do? I think that we need to be more careful about what is it that we can do. And I really believe that if nothing else, presidential candidates on the Democratic side should be unified in criticizing universally the 1996 immigration law and really calling for its abolishment, for its replacement from ground up, so that we can have an immigration law that is much more reflective of how important immigrant communities are for the U.S. And of course, I mean, fight back against this rhetoric that essentially suggests that immigrants are some sort of threat to the country when the opposite is actually reality.
Oscar Chacon, Executive Director of Alianza, you're terrific. And thank you for setting us on the correct path at this most precarious time for our sisters and brothers who are immigrants. This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.